All right, I'm itching to get into this Enneagram stuff, and I'm curious, did you take the assessment, Joe?
I did.
Awesome. We're gonna have a great conversation about that, but first we got to crank through some follow-up.
Okay.
So the question on everybody's mind is, did you time block?
I did.
How'd it
I
go?
usually at least attempt it. That's usually what I do. So this comes from Joe having angst around time blocking, but yet everybody tells me it's a thing I should do, so I feel like I should continue to try to do this. And it usually fails on me, and yet I continue to think it's a thing I should try. So I attempted this once more, this time with the intention of let's do this in the mornings. Let's not attempt to do an all day thing. We're not going to do the 24-hour thing that some people do. Do you do it 24 hours, or do you just do like your work day?
I think it's pointless to time block sleeping because I protect those hours anyways. I honestly, you know how like you put in your sleep goals into the Apple Health thing, and
Right.
I don't know if it's the default or if I set it to get 8 hours of sleep every night. That's my goal. I can count on one hand, since they added that feature, the number of days I have not gotten 8 hours of sleep. And
Nice.
that is because of my history with the epilepsy diagnosis and all that. We don't need to go rehash that whole story, but I don't want to have a seizure, so I get lots of sleep.
Nice. Yeah, so I guess in a sense you are time blocking it. You're just not writing it down.
Yeah, so
But
that's the long answer for no, I don't time block those hours, but my waking hours basically, yeah. From 7 a.m. to 9 p.m.
I feel like if I were to attempt to do that, and have attempted to do that many times, it just doesn't seem to go well because there's so much of my day that I can't control. And when you have a portion of your job that requires you to react, a significant amount of time, I guess. It gets kind of difficult to time block that. So how do you handle when fires are going to come up? So what I was attempting to do is let's time block the mornings because it seems like the mornings I can usually control somewhat, and yet I don't have to react as much during those times. So I was attempting to do this, and I will say I had some semblance of success with this one. And I think that's because I'm mostly able to kind of block off myself from, and I'm pointing over here because that's where the door is. It's currently shut with a recording sign on it. But I'm generally able to block off a lot of the distractions, interactions in the mornings, knowing that that's okay if I have time for that in the afternoon. Like if I make that available to people. It can be done. Now, I know that like Tuesdays are kind of a tough day for that because that's when like the majority of our staff is in. So Tuesdays have proven to be a bit of a challenge to make that one done. So I was only time blocking till about 10 o'clock on Tuesdays, but it seems to work okay. And I say okay because I think the portions of it that fail for me yet are potentially ADHD related, not necessarily external problems. It's more of an internal struggle that I work through. We actually may get into some of this today, but this is forever the Joe struggle, I think. But all that to say, I think I had a little bit of success with it. I want to kind of continue that experiment. We'll see if that comes of anything. I say that knowing that as soon as we're done recording here, I'm leaving for 5 days to go to a cabin with my in-laws and brother-in-law. So that'll be a fun 5 day vacation, so it'll be good, but I am not time blocking while I'm gone. Just gonna say that. That would be strange. For 45 minutes, we're gonna go fishing. For an hour and a half, we're gonna go out on the pontoon. Like I'm not doing that.
I don't time block the vacations, and I generally don't time block the weekends either, unless there's like a project that I'm trying to get done and I need the time to work on it, but try to avoid that as much as I can. So I'm with you on that. And yeah, I think you just time block the part of your day that you can actually control.
Right.
And then you try to push a little bit further in whatever direction you can once you establish that foundation.
Right. Yeah, and that seems to be what's working. So I'll continue the experiment. We'll see what comes of it. But I finally had at least some form of a success with time blocking.
Nice job.
So you have three here. How'd they go?
Mixed bag. So add daily wins to my journal. I did this. Basically, what I did is I relabeled. I had a learnings section that I didn't fill out very often. Because the way I journal, I basically have the template and I have all the different things. And the only thing I absolutely do every day is the daily questions. We've been over this before. But I have the different categories in case there's something I want to add to, like an entry or a gratitude. Or I have a section for like links that I've collected that pulls in from Pinboard. So like there's a whole bunch of other stuff I could put in here, but I don't do that every single day. So I reframe that as wins, and I feel like that's going to get me to put more things there. I was listening to maybe a John Maxwell thing, and he talked about how you either win or you learn. And I like that approach. Like if something doesn't go the way that you want it to, you can deconstruct it and you can figure out what were the factors and see if there's something there that you can change instead of just being like, oh, well, the stars didn't align for me. You know, the whole self-determination thing, which is in my wheelhouse. So I did that, but that spurred a whole bunch of other changes to my daily note template.
Of course, right? It seems like whenever you make one small tweak to something you use all the time, it has these massive cascading effects that you never planned on.
Yeah. So I added to the top of my daily note this bar for the year, which has like 12 different, you know, for things for the months, and then a little ticker so you can see like where we are in August. So it's like a year timeline sort of a thing. I also found a code that shows the progression of time for the day, the month, the year, and even wait but why style your life.
Nice.
So I have this little thing on every single daily note, the progression of time, and I can see that 50% of my life, if my lifespan is the 80 years, which you plug into like the data view JS code, you know, 50% of it is done. 66% of the year is done. 48% of the month is done. 33% of the day is done. So that's kind of cool and just updates every single day. I also found a way to get format the titles for the images on like faithlife.com. The people behind Logos, they have these like verse of the day images.
Sure.
So I figured out how to put that into the template. So it pulled the file for today and drops it into my daily note, which they're always well done and add a little bit of color to my Obsidian. And I'm also playing around with tracking some habits using the tracker plugin and also embedding tasks from Todoist.
Just going to slide that one in like it's no big deal.
Yep, let's just move on to the next one.
So we have add daily wins to your journal, and that leads to adding an entire tool. Is that what's going on here?
Kinda, yeah. So I've been messing around with task management in Obsidian, and with the task plugin, you can actually do a lot. I think I probably could make that work. But the thing that's missing for me is the ability to capture something quickly. And I don't want to have to, like for the day job, switch over to Obsidian and then capture a task. And you can't even like quick capture it in Obsidian. You got to like pick the note that you want to put it to. I guess I could just point it to like the daily note all the time, but I don't really want to do that. And so Todoist has good apps and they have quick entry shortcuts on the Mac, and it's really easy to add stuff on iOS. And it's basically, I've come to the realization that almost all task management apps on Apple devices have the same core building blocks. You know, you got tasks, you got projects, you got tags. I guess you could do priorities, whatever. But like, you can kind of build together your own system in pretty much any of these apps. OmniFocus still has the killer feature with the review. But other than that, they're kind of the same. Unless you're going to major in task management, and then you're not
you can't say this out loud, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm going to get flack for that. But the more you go into all the specifics and take advantage of all the features of these task management apps, the less work you actually do. That's the theory.
Yep.
That's what I've seen. So for my basic use, they're basically all the same. Anyways, that's a divergence. But the other thing in Obsidian, actually, they're all kind of Obsidian related today. But the next one was to build my quote book. I'm working on this, but I still can't get it the way that I like it because Obsidian, I'm sorry, they don't have block references. They have these little codes they add to the end of blocks that you can point to that block from other places, but it's not, I don't know, it's like 90% of the way there. I'm really trying to recreate what I originally had in Rome Research, and I just can't do it with the way Obsidian is put together. And I've tried all sorts of different things. A lot of the ways people are doing quote books online is they put the entire quote in the title of the note. So I started playing with that. That could work, except that there's character limits on how long the titles can be. So eventually I will find a longer quote that will not be able to fit there.
Do you want to know how I do that one? Because I do keep quotes in Obsidian. But the way I do it is, now granted, everything starts in drafts for me.
Yep.
So I tend to drop the quote in drafts, and then I have a drafts action that will grab the first 7 words and then put a dot, dot, dot at the end of it. And that becomes the title of the note. And then I drop the rest of it in the quote note itself. And then I leave it there. That's as far as it goes for me. But I just figured I'm not going to overcomplicate it.
Yeah, I have a feeling that's what I'm going to have to do is something like that, which feels a little bit janky, to be honest, just because I like sure. what I had before. But I don't think that's possible. And I'll get over it and it'll be fine. But still
haven't. Because the only thing you're really trying to do is embed a piece of an existing note somewhere else. Is that the idea? Because you want to be able to have a note that's all the quotes. And then grab a piece of it to embed it elsewhere. Is that the idea?
I don't want a single note that's all the quotes. That's the thing. Like I could do that, and then I could have all the block references and things. I don't. Yeah, that doesn't look great.
Okay.
When it's implemented, in my opinion. So sure. I feel like with Obsidian, you kind of have to do what I want to do. You kind of have to have the quotes be notes themselves, but. Was hung up on the length, the 3 dots. I think that's probably what I'll end up doing. There is a lot of advantage to having each quote as its own note, because then you can put in the YAML metadata. You could put like right. author in there. You could put topic in there. And then you could do data view queries to pull on that information. And that's pretty cool. You know, that's something that yep. I could never do before other than just do a plain text search. And hey, do any quotes have this word in it? So there's something there, but I still haven't cracked that nut. I will use your suggestion, though, and just do the dot, dot, dot.
I will say I haven't had an issue, because then you can, like, if you want to just put a link to the quote, like, it's just a shortened version, so then it doesn't take up your entire note that you're trying to link back to the quote from.
Yep.
But it also makes the process of embedding that quote pretty simple, because it doesn't take as much typing to get there. So
yeah,
that's what I find, but I know that you use it in a lot more intense ways than I do.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, I broke my node with all my images for principles, so maybe I can break Obsidian too. We'll see.
We tried with the Bible note per verse thing. Like, it's true. It almost broke.
It's true. Well, it kind of breaks on iOS, to be honest. Fortunately, I don't use it on iOS a whole lot, but.
Sure.
Because iOS has this stupid thing where they try to keep manage your space on your device. And I have tons of space available. I don't want you to ever get rid of the notes that I've downloaded from Obsidian, but it does it all the time. And it has to re-download everything.
I just want to whitelist a folder.
Everything. Exactly. Just that's all I want to do. Never delete stuff from this folder. That would take care of it. But so it's not Obsidian's fault. But anyways. And then the last one was to make a list of things to fix around my house. I did this, and of course, it's in Obsidian.
Good work. Now the question is, are you working on that list?
No, not yet. I will say it did feel good to actually make the list, though, because these are things that like I see all the time, and then it's like, oh, yeah, I got to do something about that. And now I at least have it in a list somewhere. So when I see the broken light in our master bathroom, that isn't a light bulb. It needs to be rewired and I don't want to touch it. You know, it's like, you know, I have that on the list and I'm going to get to that eventually. So you don't have to worry about that right now.
Yeah. Yep. Totally fair.
All right. Should we get into today's book?
Yes, we should. Most certainly.
All right.
Because I'm dying to know what type you are.
You do, huh?
I want to know.
All right. Well, today's book is The Story of You by Ian Morgenkron. And I have to apologize a little bit here because I assumed that we would get like a code to take the Enneagram. And we didn't. We got a push to take his $60 test, which right. I did not do.
I didn't either.
Content of the book aside, this is a strange marketing device. I actually don't think it's much of a marketing device, having done a little bit more research on him and seen some of the other stuff that he's done. But it felt weird. Like, you buy the StrengthsFinder book and you get the code to take the assessment. Like, almost every other book that we've read has been like that. And this one's like, yeah, I'm going to explain these results, but you need the results in order to really understand what this is going to mean. Oh, by the way, you can do that, but it's $60 for the cheap one and $120, I think, for the big one. It's insanely expensive compared to all the other assessment types. And I know that there are lots of free resources for Enneagram out there. So I was a little bit taken aback by that at the beginning. Like, what are you trying to do here? But yeah, so we both took an assessment. I found one that was actually research-based because there are different versions of the Enneagram, and a lot of them are just almost like Facebook quiz style, answer five questions and we'll tell you your type. And I feel like those aren't super valid. The larger sample size you have, the better results you're going to get. And I found one by RHETI. I don't know what that stands for off the top of my head.
Riso-Hudson Enneagram Type Indicator.
But that one looked like it had a whole institute behind it. Yeah, and they had done a bunch of research behind how they formulated their results and how the types tied together and things like that. So Enneagram is basically like this framework that it seems like there are a lot of different people who take a lot of different interpretations or creative license in how it actually gets implemented.
Yeah, I took the one you sent me because you have so much interest in studies and how they're done that I figured I'm not going to argue with Mike on this. So I just took the one that you gave me. And I have to say, like, it was, what was it? 144 questions. And it was basically like, pick the one that's most applicable. And when I got the results back, it's like, oh, that kind of makes sense. And then the more I read it, it's like, wait, I've got three that are like all within 2 points of each other. It's like, oh, crud. I don't ever get this whenever I do these tests. Like, it's always like, this one is very obvious, the thing. And in this particular case, I had three that were like all at the top, which now I don't know what to do with that because normally I don't have that problem. So now I have to try to figure this out between these three, I think, because it said that, you know, the top three are the ones that you're most likely to be within. So it's like, okay, now I got to try to work this out. So thankfully I took it before I read it. So I think I kind of know where I'm sitting, but I think we'll get there.
The other interesting part about the Enneagram is that you basically pick your own type. You pick the one that resonates with you. So the assessments are basically like a starting point in the journey. And then you figure out or just decide, like, this is the one that I am, which is kind of interesting because you have more agency in deciding how you're going to implement the strengths and the shadow side of all of these different types. And really, it's in your best interest to be as accurate as possible because there are things that you have to deal with and work through in order to realize the strengths of the different types. But that's different than a lot of assessments, which are just, you are this.
Right.
And now your entire life will change and fall in line with how this works.
You are this tendency. Mike loves that.
Yeah, so I think this is kind of a cool approach. And I know the Enneagram itself is kind of based off of, in the words of the Amazon description for today's book, an ancient personality typing system. So maybe that kind of leads to it. Maybe productivity books and business people weren't a thing when this existed. And so they just flew under the radar and didn't have an opportunity to say, this is the way things are. brand it their own way. I don't know.
It's a fascinating way to do it, because normally you would, like you're saying, you would have somebody tell you exactly like, here's your thing. But in this case, you know, for example, my wife is certain she knows what her type is, and yet she's not taking the quiz. Like, she just kind of read some of the descriptions. She had somebody else tell her, like, you're this. She's like, what? So then she went and read about it. Like, oh yeah, that's me to a T, 100%. So even folks who haven't taken the quiz, I feel like if you were to read like some of these synopses of each of the types, you could figure it out pretty quick. So I say that knowing that, because this is, and to be honest, I didn't really think of this book as a sales pitch. I get that it kind of is, but even if you don't take the quiz, I feel like you could get quite a bit of value out of this, because when you get to the one that is you, I feel like you'll know it pretty quick. So I don't think there's a deterrent in the book if you haven't taken the quiz. But like you're saying, there are cheaper ways to do it. I did go take the exact same one you did. That way we were both kind of on same footing with it. I didn't even look into his, because by the time I got to that point, you'd already sent me a link. So I was like, oh, okay. So I just completely skipped it and went on. I did not know it was that expensive. So maybe don't do that. I don't know. It seems weird. The way you're saying it, like that, I don't know why you would sell a book to explain results of a test that you have to pay to take. Like, it just seems weird to do it that way. But I hadn't connected all those dots till you explained it a minute ago.
Well, I'm intrigued by it now, to be honest. I kind of want to take it, because he also has a podcast called Typology, which he mentions a few times, I think, in here, but it's not really like a big self-promotion thing.
Right.
I should also say his main job, if you want to call it that, I guess, is he's an Episcopal priest.
And
and that is something I've heard about the Enneagram, is that it is kind of rooted in Christian theology. I didn't see that come through in any of the assessments that I took. But I guess if you're looking for that and are really put off by that, be aware that it seems like a lot of the Christian circles tend to like the Enneagram for some reason. It just seems like a personality type assessment to me, so whatever.
Yeah, I was, obviously as a Christian, it didn't, like, it wasn't off-putting to me, but later on in the book, he eventually, like, he starts bringing in quite a bit of biblical references and such, which I was not prepared for. I didn't know that was coming at all. But it made sense the way he explains it. So there is that component. If you're going to pick up the book, if that's off-putting to you, just be aware of it.
Yeah. I really don't think it's that...
It's not very pushy.
No, it's... At all. It's not. And a lot of the content of the Enneagram itself, really, there's not anything religious there. I bring up Typology because I listened to an episode and it was fascinating to hear him talk to somebody else and kind of act as the therapist, I guess. You know, the person who was on the show was somebody who had achieved a lot and was a three. We'll get into the specifics here, but it was kind of interesting to hear her tell her story and then him just kind of comment here and there. And everything that he added was like pretty profound, and you could tell like he really understands this stuff. So after listening to that, I kind of do want to take his assessment and see if what additional information is in there. I don't know that he's the guy for the Enneagram. There's also another app called the EnneApp, which has like a $2.99 in-app purchase for all of the information with the types. And it has a version of the assessment that you can take in there. I took that one too, and that confirmed the results that I got from the RHETI. So that one's probably pretty decent as well and much less expensive. The RHETI, by the way, I think was like $12. So it really, really wasn't bad. But the book itself is broken out into 12 different chapters. I think we have to talk about all the chapters probably, but they'll also go pretty fast, I think. Chapter one is the stories we tell. Chapter two, changing your story. Chapter three starts with the eighth story and then goes in order. I don't quite understand that one, but
it goes to the eights, the nines, and then it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah,
exactly.
Which he explains a little bit in, what was it? Is it chapter two, maybe?
Yep.
That the reason for that is because there's like triads.
Correct.
Of these, and you want to start at the beginning of those triads, which means that in order to cover the one first, he has to cover the one's triad, which actually starts with number eight.
Correct.
So that's why he has to do it that way. But if you read the table of contents like I did, and you see chapter three starts with eight, like my analytical brain is like, why can't the one's story be chapter one?
Yep.
Oh, that killed me. Because then, like, if you want to hear about the seventh story, you go to chapter 11. Like, ugh.
And there we have a clue for what type Joe is.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah, so it is different. And I got to admit, I don't really understand all the triad stuff yet. I also don't understand the wings, but whatever. So let's start here with chapter one, which is the stories we tell. And I just jotted down a couple of things for this in my Node file. And this basically, he's laying the foundation for why you should care about this stuff. He says that the Enneagram not only reveals our types, but it exposes the broken stories we tend to tell. And this is a theme that happens not just in this book, but also in the podcast that I was listening to, is the focus on the brokenness when you're struggling with your type, and then kind of the redemption that happens when you figure it out and you flow in your strength. And there's different words there. He uses passion and virtue, passion being the negative one, virtue being the positive one. So I like this, though, this framing about we're all just in the middle of our own stories. And if you want to live a different story, you have the ability to do that. And that's basically the Enneagram in a nutshell. You pick the story for the type that you want to live, and then you model your life after that. And maybe model is like gives the wrong impression, because it's not like you completely change everything. It's just kind of your perspective and how you go about the things that you do. As we get into the types, if there's one that resonates with you, you understand like, oh yeah, this is why I do this. Maybe I could do this instead, you know? And that is kind of interesting, but that's basically chapter one. Anything else you want to add there?
The only thing I want to add is that in chapter one, he's basically telling his story. And I'm not going to go into the details of that, but at the end of that process, he has a mentor who's helping him understand kind of himself. And he asks Ian the question, do you ever wonder if you're living in the wrong story? And
oh, I forgot about that. I love that part.
Yeah, it's a pretty fundamental like crux, I think, almost for the entire book because of the way he's laying it out. But it's his point is that you might be making choices and you might be living a certain way, but that doesn't mean that's where you are best suited, or it's not necessarily playing into your strengths. You're not becoming aware of your weaknesses. Like there's so many different ways you can take that. But that question, do you ever wonder if you're living in the wrong story, is fairly profound, I would say. And it's one that's, I don't want to say haunted, but it hasn't left me alone since reading that question. And I could see how that could play out for a lot of people. It's like, you know, look at your life right now. And if there's aspects of that you feel are uncomfortable or you're struggling with, maybe you're taking yourself down the wrong path. That's ultimately, I guess, what I'm getting at. But anyway, I appreciated the question, but I know you like questions.
I do love me some questions. That's actually the perfect place to go into chapter two, I think, because chapter two is changing your story. And this is where he explains that many people feel sorry for themselves while they're living in the wrong story. And we, for whatever reason, tend to be fiercely loyal to our broken stories. He mentions that all transformation starts with story transformation. And I can 100% get on board with the direction that he's going with this. Then he also talks about how each Enneagram type has a passion and a virtue. He says that your passion is the source of your suffering. That's kind of interesting. But it's also not something to be eliminated, because that passion, that source of your suffering, according to the Enneagram, when you learn to channel that, it becomes a virtue or a strength. And he's got this little acronym thing for how we're supposed to change called SOAR. See, own, awaken, and rewrite. See, this is a much better acronym than whatever that one was from. See, I can't even remember it. It failed.
You don't even need to remember it. It was terrible.
From the last book, yeah. And he also introduces the idea of agir kanta. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that is acting against. So the whole idea behind the Enneagram is you identify your type, you identify the passion, the struggle, the source of your suffering, and you act against it so you can express it positively as a virtue. Is that a fair description of the Enneagram to this point?
I think so. It's basically trying to figure out, you know, he likes this analogy of the story, which I'm totally with, which is why he starts off with Donald Miller on this particular chapter and how Donald Miller changed his own story to help lose weight, blah, blah, blah. But he does lay out how each of these revolves around your story itself, which is fitting because when he explains each of these, he tells a story to begin with. Like that's how he explains each of these. And it's even called that, the nine's story, the three's story. So
yep,
it does make a lot of sense and it's easy to resonate with that. So yeah, I think you did well.
Cool. And I did not make this connection until you brought up the Donald Miller story again. I do remember that one and the story of how he changed his story, lost weight. But that was a very small snippet. And we got a much larger version of that story in Hero on a Mission.
Right.
And I guess this is where we make our obligatory mention of how to read a book and how that's impacted us.
Yep. And how we didn't rate it well and probably should have.
We should probably go back and redo that one at some point. But that's one of those things where, like, that mention of that story impacted me probably a lot different than someone who's just picking up this one and they're like, oh, yeah, you know a guy who lost a bunch of weight. That's cool. Like, we had a very descriptive visual of that because Donald Miller is a very good storyteller himself. And we read that book. And so we have the context for that story. And it's kind of interesting to me. The longer we go with Bookworm, the more the worlds created by these books overlap.
Yeah.
And the more context you get just because you've read other things, not even from the words that are on the page of the book that we're looking at. So.
And I just to piggyback on that, I would say that this is probably why, you know, books and authors like those of Ryan Holiday tend to rank pretty well with us. And it's probably because, you know, in Holiday's case, he's so well read and so well versed in what other books are out there that he kind of breaks out of that. He doesn't tell the stories you hear in every other book. He goes and finds the stories you've not heard before. So he does kind of break out of that, which is very refreshing, at least for me, since it's something new. Whereas it's in books like this, like you were just saying with Donald Miller's story, well, we just read that whole thing. So this feels like a real small snippet, and then you can put it in the context of his entire story that we've already been through. So it does start to put a lot of pieces together, but that's also why we like the ones who don't fit the mold.
That's an interesting, brings up an interesting question for me, because I am in the process of writing a book, and I don't know exactly what it's going to, I don't know if it's going to be self-published or if I'm going to try to hook up with a publisher or whatever, but I know I need to write this thing. So I've been thinking over, like, if I'm bringing in all these other stories and all these other dots, how much do I share? Because I think the tendency is, well, you have to assume people have never heard this before. So I'm going to tell the whole story of Donald Miller.
right.
But that's not what Ian Morgenkron did. It's just like a very small piece of it. And if you want, you know, you can go find that. He doesn't even point you to the right direction. He doesn't say, go read his Hero on a Mission book, Donald Miller, you know. Leaves it.
Like, no, you want more? Go figure it out.
Yeah. Which I kind of like that. So I think I'm going to try to lean more that direction when I write mine.
Please do.
All right. The next chapter here, chapter 3, is the Eight's story. So the Eight's story, the Eight is the challenger. The passion for the Eight is, according to Ian Morgenkron, lust, and the virtue is innocence. Yeah, I got a whole bunch of stuff here for each of these, but I don't really want to just crank through all the different notes I have here. I guess I would say that the Eight tends to develop a confidence in their own ability, and they tend to view their strength and others' weaknesses as the thing that is going to help them achieve success. Kind of the shadow side of the Eight he talks about is that they can be controlling of others, and they have to realize that vulnerability is not a weakness. Anything you want to add here to the Eight's story?
I would say, you know, part of the issue I think maybe you're struggling with, and I'm going to struggle with too, is that there's so much of this that's done in story form that it's almost hard to summarize what is going on for each of these stories, that in this case the Eight's story, but there's a lot of little snippets that can come out. So like in this case, for an Eight, conflict can actually become their way of expressing intimacy. Eights earn their anger honestly. Like, there's all sorts of stuff that come with this. Eights can be fiercely protective and coach others on how they should fight harder. Like, there's a lot of those little tiny bits that can come out.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really have a place that you can go that says, oh, here's all the things that would tell you about an Eight. Like, it's not a quick summarization process. But yes, I think overall, Eights tend to be a very strong, big, what do I say? I don't want to say powerful, but very confident and not domineering, but forceful person, I guess, would be the way to say that. But
that's fair.
I think
you
get what I'm trying to say.
What I do like about the approach to each of these stories is that he does follow that SOAR framework. And so he kind of ends it with, this is how to express this positively, or this is kind of like where you want to go towards. And so at the end of this chapter, he talks about how healthy Eights care more about serving those who are following them than exercising power over them. So yeah, the Eight is kind of born for conflict, and they challenge everything, hence the name, the challenger.
Right.
Should we go on to the next one?
Yes. Yeah. I feel like we could kind of get through them and then maybe spend a little more time on our own results, maybe.
Let's do it. All right, so the next one is the Nine's story. And the Nine is the peacemaker. The passion for the peacemaker is sloth. The virtue is right action. And the Nine basically believes it's up to them to maintain unity and avoid conflict. The problem with this approach is that Nines often become invisible rather than stand up for their needs, feelings, and preferences, and they feel that what they want doesn't really matter. And this is kind of the negative expression of a Nine, if you want to frame it that way. They don't want to threaten a connection with someone, so they choose not to assert their own agenda. They can become passive aggressive as resentment grows over how they need to accommodate others just to keep peace. And I had my wife take this assessment as well. She is a Nine. Which was interesting, because when she read the names, she thought she was going to be a 4. I think that's the romantic, the one that tends to be...
the individual, I think.
According to the RHGTI, yeah. But according to...
that's right.
According to Ian Morgenkron, he frames it a little bit different. That's the one that tends to be really creative. And so she's like, oh yeah, obviously that one is me. But then when she took the assessment, she got the result back for the Nine. She's like, Actually, that's spot on.
Nice. Yeah, one of there is a list here of like some of the difficulties or struggles that each of these deal with, and just a few of these that come from the nine. What I want doesn't really matter. Everything is okay if there's no conflict. It's best not to be too affected by life. I'm a nice person who doesn't get angry. I'm okay as long as everyone else is okay. Like, sometimes those phrases kind of help me. Now, again, some of those are more negative than positive, of course, but sometimes it's easier for us to see the negatives in ourselves than the positives. So if that helps for you to resonate with one of them.
Right. All right. The next one, chapter five. Oops, I did it. Sorry. The one's story. this is the improver, and their passion is anger. Their virtue is serenity, which is kind of a strange one, I think.
Yeah.
Ones are typically remarkably mature as children are seen that way. They tend to follow the rules and they set a good example, but those high standards eventually become a burden. They work hard to be perfect and wonder why others can't relate. They believe it's their job to make the world a better place. They right wrongs wherever they find them. And they have trouble recognizing that their perfectionism is the source of their unhappiness. I mean, there's other stuff in here, but that's the gist of it.
Yeah, they're always looking to improve themselves and to be good. Some of those phrases that are in this one, what I should do is more important than what I want to do. I'll finally be happy when I'm perfect. I need to be good so people will like me. I need to be right all the time. I have to maintain control. If I relax, everything will hit the fan. The risk of being criticized or judged is not worth the shame and self-judgment it could cause. So you can kind of get a feel for, like, they want to continually improve things but have control of things.
Exactly. One of the things that they talk about that's important for ones at the end is that they need to make rest a priority, schedule vacations, days off, and downtime to recharge, which is kind of interesting. They are fully alive to the need to be better tomorrow than they are today. The lifetime task of a one is to learn to occasionally ignore duty, celebrate, and enjoy life. All right. The next one is the two, and the two is the helper. The passion of the two is pride, and the virtue of the two is humility. And they see themselves as the helpers. They have trouble asking for help themselves because they don't want to appear selfish, and they end up putting others' wants and needs above their own. While they're young, they learn to disown their own needs and focus on helping those around them. They are people pleasers. They tend to adjust their image to make people like them. And they gravitate towards meeting the needs of others in ways that reflect their own.
Yeah, and some more of these phrases. My needs are so great, they will overpower anyone who sees them. People like people who are always cheery and who flatter them. People who know me should already know what I need. If I express my needs, others will reject and abandon me. That's kind of, to me, that's kind of strange. Like, if you're so willing to help someone else, wouldn't you be willing to ask for help so that somebody else could have that same feeling? Anyway, I probably want too much. Winning the approval of others is key to my feeling worthy. I guess one of the things that kind of stands out to me is there's so much like externalizing of your own worth with that. So I could see how that could get to be pretty difficult.
All right, the next one is the three. The three is the performer. The passion of the three is deceit, and the virtue is authenticity, which is a little bit strange when you first hear that. I will add that the typology podcast episode that I listened to, I mentioned that was a three, and so having listened to that, I see this a lot better now than having just read the book itself. Basically, the story that was mentioned on the podcast was this person was really successful early on in their life, and then they just did everything that they could to maintain that external picture in people's eyes. So early in life, from the book now, threes confirm to the expectations of the important people in their life. They tend to struggle with feeling like they can't be loved for who they are. It's all based on what they do. They can feel like their dreams don't matter. They have to follow their family's expectations. They want to make their parents proud, but they don't realize it when they do. One of the stories he mentioned in the book that kind of hit me was, I think it was Jeff Goins was a three. And he's talking to his dad and he's like, I just want you to be proud of something that I do. And his dad's like, I'm proud of everything that you've done.
Yeah.
And very short story, but that really hit me. I'm not tipping my hat, by the way, to the one that I am. This is not me.
Yeah, it is interesting too, because, you know, as I mentioned, he does tell a story for each of these. Do you notice he gives last names on all of them? Like, you could go hunt these people down with a search and figure out kind of their background and such. Normally, people try to obscure the identity of these folks, but not at all here. He's got full names. You can go learn all about them. So anyway, for the threes, some more of these phrases. I'd be happier if I were more successful. If I'm not number one, I'm nothing. The world rewards doing, not being. I'm valuable when others admire me. Failure isn't an option. If you're not a somebody, you're nobody. It's okay to wear a mask to win over different types of people. But I think, you know, the thing that probably stands out the most to me about this one is the whole deceit versus authenticity piece that you were talking about. Like, okay, I value authenticity so much that I'm going to deceive people in order to maintain that.
Yeah.
It just seems kind of backwards. But yet, that sort of thing happens with all of these. I'm not just calling out the threes here. Like, there are a lot of those for each of these types.
I wonder if the reason he uses the last names is because they have appeared as guests on his podcast. Because podcast has been around for quite a while. I was pretty impressed by the number of episodes that they had in the backlog. I didn't count them all up, but there must have been hundreds. So it wouldn't surprise me if he has relationships with these people, that he's had them on the podcast. And
sure,
the podcasts are always like this episode with this person where the last name is published already.
Obviously, so. There. Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, this is an interesting one. Like sevens and eights, threes can be aggressive in getting what they want. They tend to be highly competitive. They're not sure how to respond to the emotional needs of others because they can be out of touch with their own. They tend to equate their worth with their accomplishments. They struggle with work-life balance. They always feel on. And this is the point in the book where I was like, I need to listen to this typology podcast. That was actually an action item I jotted down, but I couldn't wait until after we recorded. So I've actually started listening to it already, and it's pretty good.
Nice.
It's probably not like a lot of the other podcasts that I listen to, and I'm guessing a lot of the listeners of Bookworm would listen to. He's got a producer that he works with, so it's like very polished and kind of like NPR style, but not all the way that way. And then also I would say it's got tinges of like your standard productivity podcast stuff in there, but it's a good mix, I feel, and it lands in a sweet spot of like, this feels like a unique sort of thing, and very entertaining. The couple of episodes that I've listened to one, and I've started listening to another. So it'll probably stick around for me just till I get bored with the Enneagram, at least.
Give it a month and you'll be done.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. All right. The next one is the Four's story. And the Four is the romantic, according to Ian Morgan Cron, anyway. The passion is envy. The virtue is equanimity. And fours feel like they don't fit in when they're young. They usually feel unseen or misunderstood. And by the way, a lot of the notes and the stories that he shares in these different chapters, as I'm sharing this information, they all start with like when they're young, because typically that's when you sort of form your type, which is kind of interesting to me. It's not like you're just born this way. You are kind of a product of your environment. And if you have these like traumatic things that happen to you, then working through them a certain way could end up making you lean towards a certain type. But again, going all the way back to the beginning, you have the power to change your story. So just because you grew up a four doesn't mean you're stuck in a four. Like, you can be whatever you want. You just need the motivation to live it out, basically. Fours tend to pursue lost love from a vague feeling that they were abandoned and that it was their fault. They regularly switch interests or jump clicks. They project an image of specialness or uniqueness in order to feel appreciated. They feel things more deeply than other people. They feel like a misfit, and they always find the other misfits. They can be moody or unpredictable, full of creative ideas, but have trouble following through on them. Tend to be depressed and irritable when not creating. They don't shy away from the big questions. They willingly engage with the heavy stuff and can sniff out anything fake easily and seek authenticity.
Yeah, and some more of these phrases here. It's probably my fault when a relationship goes south. I feel things more deeply than other people. You kind of just mentioned that one. Life will always be vaguely disappointing. It's pretty cheery. I'm magically special. Because I'm defective, I'll be abandoned. It's interesting that those two are back-to-back in this list. I will be denied the love I seek. I will never be understood. I can't be ordinary. Like, there's a lot of conflicting things in this one as well. But this is one where in the READETI that you and I took, the R-H-E-T-I, they call it the individualist. I don't know why they would have different names. Is this not a normalized thing? I guess I don't know the Enneagram that well, but it seems strange that they'd have two different names for it.
Yeah, good question. I did not dig into this, but my guess is that there are people who have tried to update it and kind of like a, you know, different Bible translation, you know, make it more modern.
Oh, sure.
I would guess that's what Ian's feels like to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that does make sense. I know this is one that, thankfully, I was a bit nervous when I got to this one because he calls out very early on that he's a four.
Yeah.
And typically when you have something like this, and the author obviously has to identify themselves as which one they are. And normally when you would get to the one that they are, they spend a little more time on it because they like it and they resonate it with it and it's theirs. He didn't do that. So I was grateful that he kind of just kept the same approach. He didn't, you know, make it sound like it's the one that you should have and this is the one you should be because I'm this one. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't take that approach like some people do. So I did appreciate that. He at least kept it on an even keel there.
Yeah, that sounds ridiculous, but it's totally true. That happens in a whole lot of other places.
Yeah.
All right, the next one is the five, and the five is the investigator. The passion for the five is avarice. Not sure if I'm saying that right, but basically it is immoderate desire for wealth is the dictionary definition. The virtue is non-attachment. And when we get into some of this other stuff, you'll see why the avarice fits. They tend to seek mastery and they love learning. They tend to be drained by prolonged social interaction, have a natural tendency towards detachment, isolation, and analysis. And four or five, knowledge is power. They have the thickest personal boundaries of any type. As kids, they can see mature beyond their years. They don't like being overdependent on others. They can grow up isolated by their circumstances or families. They feel emotions, but tend to let them go without fully processing them. They can... others can find fives eccentric or odd, which they use as justification for self-isolation. They can collect a lot of knowledge, but may have trouble applying it. And essentially, that is the whole goal of the five, is to get more information, to get more knowledge, believing that that is going to lead to more success. So you can kind of see how, like, a lot of entrepreneurs probably fit into the five category. It's interesting because as I was reading through some of these, there were some of my kids where I was like, this is totally what they are. Some of them I had a little bit more trouble figuring out. When I read this to Toby, he's like, oh yeah, that's me.
Yeah. So the fives, here's some of the false beliefs, as he calls these, that I've been reading. It's safer to observe than to participate. If I open up to relationships, people demand more than I have or want to give. If I'm spontaneous or express my feelings in the moment, others will disapprove and I'll feel embarrassed and out of control. The more I know, the safer I'll be. So I guess that does kind of fit into the whole, you know, let me learn as much as I possibly can. Information is power concept. So data people probably fit this really well.
Right. Yeah.
This is not me, by the way. Spoiler alert.
Chapter 10 is the Six's story. The Six is the loyalist. The passion for the Six is fear. The virtue is courage. They have a deep desire to uphold fairness, justice, and traditional values. They're reliable, dependable. They uphold what is right and good. They panic without safety growing up, and they live in a constant state of anxiety. These are the people who kind of always look for the worst case scenario. They tend to be really loyal to who and what can offer them protection and security. They're quick to heed warnings from overly protective adults. And he mentions that there are two kinds of anxiety. I think that's anxiety or stress, but basically there's phobic and counterphobic. And phobic is where you assume everything is dangerous and you avoid it. Counterphobic is where you train to meet the challenges and overcome the worst case scenarios in your head. And that's obviously the one that you want to get to if you are a six.
Yeah, the outline seems correct to me, by the way. Chapter 10 is six. I don't know what your mind node file looks like. I don't have that in front of me. Anyway, some of the false beliefs, the faulty beliefs of a six. I'll be safe if I prepare for the worst. If I worry and plan enough, everything will turn out okay. It's hard to not doubt or to trust people when so many of them have hidden agendas. Can't trust myself to make good decisions. I'll always be filled with doubt and worry. I won't be safe or certain unless I have something or someone outside myself to trust and be loyal to. So again, this one's very external reliant, I would say, and that they're dependent on someone else or something else that they're remaining loyal to, thus the loyalist title. So yeah, that's kind of another external one.
Yeah, he also mentions that there are more sixes than any other Enneagram type. And there's a couple of these where he offers some practical advice. We skipped over the one for the five, which, what was it? It was, got to find it now. There was one where he specifically said that they should practice gratitude. In the six, he mentions that you should limit the information that you consume on a daily basis. And I think this is good advice, whether you are a six or any other type, but it's kind of cool to see those things sprinkled in there as like practical things that you could do right now. And as opposed to just a list of all of the productivity advice and all the life hacks that whenever you read those things, you're like, oh, I should create this habit and I should do this thing and I should do that thing.
Yep.
This was a better approach. I felt like it's like, you know, of all that stuff that you could do, the one that's really going to move the needle for you is this one. So I like that.
Yeah, and one of those he calls out here for the sixes is that, the way he puts it, most sixes eventually recognize that they must develop wellness plans and coping strategies if they're ever going to enjoy their lives. And I guess that's because, the external dependency there. So if you're going to be loyal to things, like you have to have your own coping strategies in order to handle things when someone else isn't quite as loyal as you are.
Right, right. All right, the next one is the seven, and the seven is the enthusiast. The passion for the seven is gluttony, the virtue is sobriety, and this one I jotted down a lot. I love some of these definitions he's got here. He says, sevens are caffeinated from birth.
Yes.
Everyone loves sevens because they bring joy to everything. They prefer to suffer privately than let anyone see that they hurt. They have selective memory and focus on the best. They look to take care of themselves with new adventures and positive distractions. They don't like being bored, trapped, or locked into a routine. They have an insatiable appetite and zest for life. In adolescence, they find themselves the center of attention. Others want to be with them. They're spontaneous, outrageous, and innovative in finding ways to be the center of attention. They're the first to think that the action is elsewhere. Their contagious energy cannot be suppressed. Most people cannot keep up with a 7 and aren't willing to try. They need options and possibilities. They get frustrated just hanging out and doing nothing. And when I read this description, I showed it to my wife and she's like, oh, that's Malachi. And it was interesting because there is some tension between my wife and Malachi specifically, because we call him Million Mile an Hour Malachi. He's up at 7 every single day because that's the time we have set, is like, you can't get up before this.
Right.
But every day on the dot, he comes out of the room at 7 because he doesn't want to waste a minute living life.
Yes.
And it can get exhausting for my wife to keep up with him. And it comes across sometimes as like he's always looking ahead to the next thing. And it comes across as like he's not listening or paying attention. He's not, but it's not because he's a bad kid or he's an act of rebellion. He's just constantly looking for the next new thing.
Yep.
And because his mind moves so fast, it can be frustrating. It's like, well, I just told you, you need to do this first.
Yes, but I was focused on this other thing, so I have no idea what you said.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, some of these mistaken beliefs of a 7. I can't endure feeling bored, trapped, locked into a routine, or FOMO, fear of missing out. I must have multiple escape options. I can't depend on anyone for anything, especially for supporting me when I'm in pain. Charm is the best first line of defense. No one can be trusted to satisfy me. I'm on my own. What I really want can't be found in the present moment or inside myself. It's always outside and in the future. So very fast moving, I would say, as you're calling out.
Yep. All right. The last chapter is chapter 12, The Larger Story. And this is just a couple of like closing thoughts here. He mentions, and this is actually where the religious part comes out, so skip this chapter if you're not, that's off-putting to you, because he's really just reiterating again that we are all broken in some way. Nobody's perfect. And he says that when we let God put us back together, the result is something that is better than new, and uses the story of that Japanese pottery that is broken and then like remade, and you can see all the cracks. And most of the time you would think like, well, if something is cracked, then it's worthless or it's devalued. And he said that, no, this specific type of Japanese pottery, the fact that you can see all the cracks and they've been meticulous in putting it back together, that's actually the thing that makes it valuable. And I feel like that's a pretty cool way to wrap this all up. It's like, you're not going to be perfect. We've all got these cracks. So just own them, do the best that you can, and you'll come out better on the other side.
Yeah, I like you're saying, like, this is where the spiritual religious side comes out. I don't feel like this is, like, from a Christian stance and from a biblical stance, I feel like it's fairly well done. I don't feel like there's anything I would argue with him on theologically here. That's not the point of this podcast at all. But the thing that is interesting to me is that he went so deep in it, and it was so point blank, like, here's how this, your story, like the number your story, this is how it fits into the bigger story of God. And that's not a place I expected him to go at all. And yet here we are, and I'm not arguing with that at all. It was kind of refreshing to me, because we don't normally see that in a book. I appreciate that in this one. But again, most people, I don't know where you would sit. So I don't think I knew that the Enneagram had kind of a spiritual Christian undertone to it. Maybe I'm misinterpreting what you said earlier, but if that's true, then this totally makes sense. I just haven't put all those pieces together yet.
I don't think it's that explicit in the nature of the Enneagram itself.
Okay.
But I think Episcopal priest. So
yeah.
Overlap of all the different things, kind of like my approach to faith-based productivity. You know, it's who I am, and so it's going to color my perspective on the stuff in that realm. That's my interpretation of this last chapter, but I could be wrong. I mean, I really don't know enough about the Enneagram itself, the RHETI that we mentioned that we both took, and we'll get into our results here in a second. This is something that is put together by the Enneagram Institute, and reading through this, like, I've got a PDF, which is 18 pages long, explaining my results. Yeah. Didn't see anything religious in here, you know? So I think that's just Ian Morgan Cron coming. Yeah. His lens on how he applies this stuff, which I agree. Like, I think that's kind of cool, but other people take it or leave it. I wouldn't disregard the rest of this book just because of that last chapter, if that is off-putting to you. I think there's some good stuff here. Like I said, I picked this book not knowing that he was an Episcopal priest, just because it seemed like a Enneagram resource that a lot of people were talking about. And I wanted to understand more about the Enneagram itself. So
yeah, it makes sense.
But yeah, interesting way to end it. Should we talk about our results now?
Sure. This will be fun.
All right. Why don't you go first, since I've been kicking off most of these sections today?
Okay. I can do that. So I need to preface this with, and I'll give my numbers here, because this will help you understand why I'm still kind of like, not 100% certain what I would call myself right now. It's between two. So per the test, the top three I had as a 7, a 4, and a 9. And the names for those, the 7 is the enthusiast, Malachi, like we were just talking about. The 4 would be the individualist, according to the Ready, or the romantic, according to Ian Morgan Cron. And then the 9 is the peacemaker. The numbers on these, this is why I get a little bit off. The 7 is a 23. That was my score for the 7, was a 23. The 4 was a 21, and the 9 was a 21.
Okay.
So they're all right there. And part of my on that is that as I was going through these, we had like two phrases and you had to pick between the two, right? And I don't know if it's just the way my brain works or what it was, but there were a lot of those where you'd have to pick, like, I have this tendency between these three things, and then the second option would have another three things. But it's like, well, I'm kind of two of each of those. And I, like, it's a toss-up one way or the other. And I had probably 10 or 15 of those questions that I felt like it was a toss-up. And I get why, you know, they force you to pick one or the other. They don't give you both. I don't want them to give me a both on that, because I understand that can screw up the test. But I'm also aware that because of that, I can't be too specific on those exact numbers. So that said, according to this test, I would be a 7. And as I read through the 7, like the fast pacedness, the...
Hold on a second. Go. Because on the top of the first page, your probably says the same thing. It says your highest score, your second highest score. And I actually got a tie between my two second highest scores as well. And then it says your primary Enneagram personality type is most likely the highest of these scores and almost certainly among the highest two or three. So right. My question to you would be, going through and reading these descriptions, which one do you kind of gravitate towards? Which one resonates with you?
And that's kind of where I'm getting, because I know that with like the 7 that they're putting at the top of that list, like, yes, there's a large amount of that I would resonate with. But I feel like the second one here with the 4s is probably there. This is where I want to know about like this wings thing, because I know that can like... there's this, but then you could also be like one off on the side, and then that tends to look like a 7. Like, I'm aware of that out there as well. So I'm not sure what that... I don't know that side very well. That said, between the 7, 4, and 9, I think I would put it somewhere in that 4 range. I'm fairly confident on that. But I haven't had a chance to work through this in detail with my wife quite yet. And I feel like whenever she looks through these, she's like, yep, that one. Like, she's probably going to point it out right away. So that's my assumption. So right now I'm leaning towards, this is like, I'm a 4 is what I would say. So anyway, there's that.
If I had to pick one for you, I would have picked a 4, because some of these things I jotted down totally apply to you. Like,
sure.
Do the creative things that feed your soul. I've known you long enough and seen you do enough creative projects that, like, when something, you don't like doing it anymore, you just stop doing it.
Correct. Absolutely.
You move on to the next one.
Yep. Yeah. It's 100% what I do, which is honestly, that particular character trait is one that has me like locking in on the four more than anything else. Like I get the whole high speed thing of a seven, but I think the seven, like we were talking about the high speed piece, that's probably the ADHD that comes out in that. So it's not necessarily a typical view. That's where I think like the four probably is what it is, but because of the flavor of the ADHD, it has like that tendency to morph into a seven sometimes, but not always. So I could definitely see how that plays out. So it's good to know you think I'm a four. Awesome. Thanks, Mike.
I also think that, going back to that description, you know, do the creative things that feed your soul, and the emphasis on the creating. And again, this is like how I got connected with you, has always been your creative projects. But I think that need to create for a four maybe appears like a seven as well, because people are like, oh, he's constantly doing things. But really, it's just you constantly expressing things that you have to, because that's how you find meaning in the day to day.
I have to make things. It's true, because I know that, like, okay, so look at a lot of the things I tend to do. So I tend to write a lot of code and I make things for myself, right? But when I go home, it's very common for me to spend time like building random things. I got to make stuff with my hands as well. So I'm regularly trying to dream up how to make things. Like, and it's silly stuff like, how do I get the door to the chicken run to open without me having to crawl underneath inside the run to get to it? Like, can I get some sort of rope mechanism over here to do this for me? And how do I get it to hold down so that critters don't get in? All these things like that. That's like right up my alley. I'll do that all day long. So that's where I think like the four piece can come out. But again, like you're saying, like it, in certain instances that can make it look like other stories, which is probably true for all of them. That was the part that I learned just in reading these test results. Like, okay, they've got me at a seven at the top. It's possible I'm tied with a nine off the four. But at the same time, like, I feel like everybody's probably going to have something like that whenever you take these tests. Like, yeah. There's always going to be one or two others like, oh, yeah, I do like half of those things. But it's because the one that you're on, like in my case, the four, like it can look like one of the other ones. So you have to keep in mind like your internal feelings on that, like what is your motivator for it, not necessarily the actions that come out of it, if that makes sense what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. It does.
So there you go. Well, for now we're gonna say Joe's a four. I don't know what to do with that right now, but there we go.
All right, do you want to try to guess what I am?
Off the top of my head, I was going to guess a three.
Three. Interesting. Okay. Not a three. That is on my results, number four on the list.
Okay.
So I guess technically there's a possibility that I would be a three.
Not likely though.
Yeah. So my second and third one that I tied, second highest score was a tie between type six and type eight. So the loyalist and the challenger. Yep. And I can definitely see flavors of those in, my experiences. But the highest score, and this is definitely the one that resonates with me, is the one.
Okay.
I am a reformer.
Yep.
And there's one thing specifically here. It says one of the lifetime tasks of the ones is to learn to occasionally ignore duty, celebrate, and enjoy life. I put like a hand raise emoji because that is me.
Yeah.
I feel like there's one of these, which is the loyalist, right? But this is how the loyalist is expressed for me, is like, well, I said I was going to do this, and so I'm going to do it, even if it destroys me. And over the years, I've had to learn to say, you know what, it's okay if the thing doesn't get done.
Yeah.
But I would, you know, stay up all night to get the thing done if I said to somebody that I was going to do it. And typically it was with other people, you know, making a commitment to somebody else. The commitments to myself weren't as big a deal. But the other thing that really illuminating to me was the need to make rest a priority, to schedule vacation days off and downtime to recharge. That it's not exactly a vacation, and it's a very different type of energy. In some ways it is a form of rest, but not really. I do feel like this is the whole idea behind the personal retreat stuff, though. It's not that I can disconnect from it and not do anything and fill my tank, but it's just getting away from the day-to-day and thinking about things, and that clarity is the, I don't know, maybe it's artificial rest, right? But it's physically taking a break and mentally understanding what is the most important thing. And the most important thing is obviously the mission or the purpose that the one is going to achieve, is going to attach to. Like, I'm going to make the world a better place and yeah. impact as many people as I can. That's totally me.
out of curiosity, how close were the other two, the 6 and the 8?
They were pretty close.
Were they not even close?
So the score for type 1 was a 26, and then 22 was the tie.
Okay. Yeah, because I think, you know, the 8 is probably one I was... Like, that would have been my second guess, because I know your stances with conflict and stuff. My wife is an 8, which is super fun. So we've figured a lot of that out, but that's probably where I would have put you as like my second guess. But yeah, I think I could see the 1. I definitely could. Like, the improver slash reformer, like I could see that pretty easy. It seems like, you know, whenever you get a mission in mind, like, nothing else matters until that's done. If it's ever done, like, that's where you tend to go, and like, nothing's going to stop you from achieving that. So I can see that one pretty easy, which is maybe this is why you and I get along so well. You're on a mission and I can dream up ways to get there.
Probably. So when did you take the assessment? Did you take it before you read the book or after?
Before.
Okay. I thought you said you took it before. I intentionally took it after, because I wanted to read through all of these and see which ones resonated with me. And I saw like different things in the one, but that's not what I would have picked for me prior to taking the assessment. Like you, I probably would have seen like the 8 or the 6. And it's interesting, because even like the Peacemaker, I recognized that there were the 9, like that's there were things in there that resonated. Like, I remembered specific things from my childhood where I ended up playing the Peacemaker role quite a bit. But I think that's partly because family dynamics, and my dad was probably an 8 or a 3. Yeah. But when I got done reading the book, I'm like, I have no idea what I am. I can identify with pretty much all of these, even though type 9, the Peacemaker, the score I got for that was a 6. Like, that's the last one on the list.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I tried to guess, you know, what I thought I was going to be. And then I took the assessment, and then I looked at the results of the assessment. I'm like, huh, not what I expected, but totally agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I took it before, because I know that I have this tendency of, if I know what some of the results can be, like, I can sometimes accidentally color the results by the way that I answer questions. So I didn't want that. I wanted it to be as true as I could. So I was like, if I take this beforehand and I don't know what's coming, I'll be more prone to having more accurate results. So I think that worked out well. It's interesting you point out, like, the one that's at the bottom, an 8 is at the very bottom with me, but I'm tied at the bottom for a 1. So 1 and 8 are tied at the bottom. So there you go. We're like on opposite ends of this spectrum here.
Interesting. All right. Should we talk about action items?
Sure. What you got?
I have 2 action items, and one of them I did already. That was to listen to Typology. The other one was to check out an app called Dailyo. I forget which type that was associated with. It wasn't one of my major ones, but that sounded like an interesting application. So I'm going to take a look at that. Not make any promises about using it every day or anything like that, but I think it is like a mood logging sort of a thing, which I've sort of been on the lookout for something like that for a while. I've used Mood Notes in the past, and it's really cool, but I kind of don't think it's being actively developed anymore. So I want to find something that is going to be around for a while. I don't want to add something like that to Obsidian. It feels like a bridge too far to get that data in there as part of the daily note. But if I have something on my phone, because I do things on my phone that are part of my habits and routines, like practicing Spanish every day. So this could be something that I would stack on top of that habit, potentially. So those are my two. Which ones do you have, or do you have any action items, I guess?
Yeah, I have a couple. One of which is also listen to Typology. I don't know how far it's going to go, but when I get there, I'm going to pick the latest one, listen to that, and see if it's something I want to hold on to. Just because I think it's mentioned in almost every single chapter. I know you had said you weren't sure how often he talked about it. It was a lot, I think. Like, that was just my perspective. So that's one. I want to at least attempt an episode of that. We'll see how it goes. The other one is, and this is me before, and I'd written this down beforehand, but I was kind of assuming I was going to land on a four. Talking through it with you, I'm kind of more into that. But I had written down to focus more on my creativity. And I'm not real sure what that means right now. I'm hoping that this next week of me being gone out on a lake and having a chance to just take a break, which I don't do well, I'm hoping that can kind of help me crystallize that a little bit. But I'm trying to figure out how making things is something I can make more regularly. I know that I do some stuff online, but I do a lot of things with my hands, but I've not really given myself permission to make that a focal point, partly because it feels like it's a splurge. Like, it feels like I'm indulging in something that I shouldn't be. But that's okay. I just need to learn that that's okay. But again, I'm not real sure what that's going to look like. So I'm trying to basically nail down, how do I allow myself to be creative more often and make that a regular thing that I can kick out. So again, I'm not real sure what that looks like quite yet, but it's something I need to explore explicitly. So there's that. That's what I got, those two.
All right. So then, style and rating. My book, I will go first. I really like the style of this book. It's very different. And in a lot of ways, it's not at all what I expected. But that is largely based on what the Enneagram actually is, I feel, because I kind of thought it was a standard assessment and it was going to give you, this is the results and this is what you are. I'm kind of glad that it didn't. I'm kind of glad that the approach is basically, well, you're probably one of these, but attached to the story that resonates with you the most. So that's cool. Ian is a great storyteller. I really like the whole framing of this book around the stories and the broken stories and not trying to hide the imperfections. I feel that is something that came up on a lot of the different types, is the tendency to try to do that in different ways. And I totally agree with them that that's unhealthy. And the first step is just owning that stuff and working through it, not being afraid to tackle the hard questions. He's got some great stories. I think he's got a great writing style. It's borderline humorous, I would say.
It's fair.
I feel like he's not trying to be funny, so it doesn't come across as like awkward or dry. Just certain things, you know, one line here and there. It's kind of Donald Miller-esque, but not to that level. So I'm having trouble picking a number for this, though. I think I'm going to go 4.0 just because I'm not sure. I would guess that there are probably better resources for the Enneagram out there, though. I like the stories that he uses, but I also feel like the way the chapters are framed, if you were just looking for like more information on the types themselves, the format is maybe not the best way to do that. And maybe that's the elements of the five, you know, showing up there, but like, just give me the list, right? He had one list at the beginning of the different types and then the passion and the virtue. But I feel like the whole idea behind the Enneagram is ripe for that kind of thing. Like, give me a summary table at the end of each one of these chapters. I'm not saying you needed to do that, but there's an opportunity to take that approach. And, you know, maybe that would have been better. I don't know. But overall, I'm really glad that I read it. I'm really glad that I took the assessment. Still kind of bummed that I didn't get a code to take his by reading his book. But whatever, I'll get over that. It is kind of weird. Like, there is no official Enneagram assessment. So when you go search for one, you'll get like a whole bunch of different results. And it's kind of confusing, like, which one you should start with. So there'll be links to the RHETI that you and I both took in the show notes for this, as well as the Ennie app, which is the only decent iOS one that I saw. But yeah, 4.0, I would recommend it. But I think there's a possibility that maybe if someone were to say, what is the absolute best Enneagram resource out there, this maybe isn't it.
Yeah, I know that his writing style is very interesting. In that, like, I love that he would tell a story. I love that he had kind of a framework that he worked through for each type with the SOAR, S-O-A-R. And I think that that's probably the best way to come at this. It's like, you got to have some systematic way of coming through these. It absolutely drove me nuts that it wasn't in line with chapter numbers and in order. Completely irrational. I get it, but it drove me absolutely bonkers. Like, I would look at the, like, I kept getting like the numbers screwed up in my mind because I got them
screwed up on the episode.
Yes. Like, we would get to the four story, but it's chapter eight. So then, like, I translated it to, it was the eight that I was reading about, but he kept saying four. And it's like, why are you talking about four? We're on eight. No, that's chapter eight. Like, it just completely messed with me way more than it probably should have. I couldn't, like, the number thing was just driving me nuts, and I couldn't let that one go. So I have to say that that's a ding on it. I don't know how you do it though. Like, like, you're trying to get chapter 1 through 9 to make those line up, but I get that he was trying to do the triad thing. Maybe that was unnecessary, probably unnecessary because he never talked about the triads in depth so that you could understand those, because there's too much involved. He didn't talk about the wings thing that I know exists. There's also like there's like a circle. If you, the test that you and I took, the ready test, there's a circle with a triangle. So you've got like the 7 leans towards a 1 or a 3 for your strength or weakness or whatever. I forget what they call it, but there's those types of things going on. Those aren't even mentioned that I could find in this book. So there's a lot more to the Enneagram than what's in this book. That much I know. And I don't know what those really are. And I don't know if he should have brought those up, but all of that combined just made it kind of difficult for me to say that, like, this is your go-to resource for the Enneagram. But I think you're in agreement with me on that, is that this is probably not the go-to place to learn all the ins and outs of the Enneagram. I don't know what that place is. If somebody's listening to this and you know the answer to that, please point me to it. Point us to it. So we'd love to know that, but I know that this is probably not it. That said, just from a style and author's perspective, for what he's doing, I think he did a good job. I just don't think that this is your go-to. That's all I'm saying. So that all said, there's a lot of great stuff here. Picking a number for it, I think you're absolutely correct. It's difficult to do that because of so much that's going on here, but that said, I think I'll join you at the 4.0. It just seems like that's the right spot to be. It doesn't seem like it's so bad. It needs to be a 3-something. But yeah, I think a 4.0 is a good place for it to be. So I'll join you there.
Cool. On the topic of the additional resources for the Enneagram, by the way, he did come out with very recently the Story of You workbook, which I have, but it's like 100 pages, and these are not simple fill-in-the-blank style answers. So I haven't had time to go through that yet. I feel like this is going to be a significant effort in order to complete this, but it's quite possible that that would explain the the wings and triads and all that kind of stuff. So
that makes sense.
Give them the benefit of the doubt there. All right. Let's put the story of you on the shelf. What's next, Joe?
I want to read Mind Map Mastery by Tony Buzan, because Mike does his Mind Node Files, and I've been listening to ADHD Nerds by Jesse Anderson a lot lately, and it's come, the concept of mind mapping has come up a couple times there, and it seems like something that would be helpful to me, and I feel like I want to read a book about it, so I'm going to drag everybody along for the ride, and I figured Mike's a good resource to have along for that ride since he's been doing it for 4,000 years. So Mind Map Mastery by Tony Buzan. That's what we're going through next.
All right.
And following that, what are we doing?
Following that, we are going to read I Didn't Do the Thing Today by Madeline Doerr.
Ah.
Have you seen this?
Like something I do a lot.
It's a book about overcoming productivity guilt, which I feel is a trending topic at the moment. The whole idea of like the toxic productivity. And it looks very interesting. I saw it come across as like an Amazon recommendation or something. And typically like I just move on past those, but that one caught my eye, clicked on it, and read the description, and I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. Completely forgot about it. And then somebody that I respect brought it up the other day, and I was like, oh, yeah, I got to read that book.
Nice. Nice.
You got any Gap books?
I'm not quite done with it, but I'm still in the middle of Digital Zettelkasten. Kasten? I don't know how you say it. I've heard it both ways. Anyway, I'm still kind of in the middle of that. So I'm planning to finish that up while I'm out this week and then dive into the mind map piece. So that's kind of where I'm at with books right now. You?
Cool. I do have a Gap book that I haven't made a whole lot of progress on, and I'm going to actually pause until I get through Mind Map Mastery. But that is The Earned Life by Marshall Goldsmith. Marshall Goldsmith, I heard a podcast episode that he was on. Might have been Shane Parrish. Did you know that Shane Parrish has a podcast?
I feel like I should have.
The guy behind the Great Mental Models books. It might be a Farnham Street podcast, but the episode I heard had Shane on. The audio quality was garbage, but Marshall Goldsmith sounds like a cool guy.
Yeah. Interesting. No, I didn't know there was a podcast by Shane.
I'll see if I can find that podcast episode that I found and put a link in the show notes if I can dig it up. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us on this journey. Thank you to everyone who listened live. Thank you specifically to our Bookworm Club premium members who are willing to pitch in a couple of bucks every month to help us keep the lights on. Your support really means a lot. It's $5 a month, $50 a year. You can go to bookworm.fm/membership if you want to join. When you join, you get a couple of goodies like my mind map files, a couple of Gap episodes that Joe did back in the day, a 4K wallpaper that I created. But the big thing is that you are helping us to continue to do Bookworm. So thank you very much for all your support. And if you want to join, again, bookworm.fm/membership.
And for all you amazing people who read along with us, you can pick up the book Mind Map Mastery by Tony Buzan, and we will cover that one with you in a couple of weeks.